The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. Let's see. Well, we have a nice group here. I was going to ask people to move up. Why don't we move up just a little bit? You can bring your chairs up if you don't mind. It makes a group a little bit more cozy. You don't have to worry about catching colds from other people, because here we use the Vipassana cough or sneeze, which is into the crook of our arm. We learn that from meditation retreats. If we're there with 100 people, it's easy to have a lot of bugs spread around, so that seems to help. So, welcome, everybody. Why don't I start out? Cheryl did an intro with some of you who were here. But one of the things about mindfulness that is always mentioned is being comfortable. So how do you be comfortable when you're sitting in these postures? So I'll just mention a couple of brief things. I'll try to include things I've experienced myself over the years that have helped make things easy, and mention things that have been hindrances, and if it's useful for you, great. If it's not, set it aside, and if it's a truth, if it's relevant, it'll come back at another time. So I'll start out with just the very basics, like the posture. You notice that I'm sitting on a bench now, and to have that bench be the right height, I use this cushion and the pillow underneath it, and that seems to put me at the right height, so it doesn't put undue pressure on my knees. Because I'm short, but my legs are rather stocky, so I pull my calves and my thighs opposite directions, and it makes it more comfortable in the knees. And it took me a lot of retreats to find positions that seemed to work. And Gil is a great help with this. And the cushion works pretty well for a lot of people. It did for me before my knees started, and the hips bothered me. But one of the things that Gil showed me was to have it be more comfortable sitting cross-legged. Again, pull your calf up and pull this foot so that the foot is flat on the ground. I see sometimes people on Sunday morning, somebody sitting cross-legged flat on the floor and kind of leaning over, and I think, oh my God, that poor guy, how does he possibly sit like that? So it really makes for a solid, nice platform by moving your foot like this and bringing this leg down like so. And that way it makes a nice triangle. And it's a more solid pose, so that when you become more concentrated, you don't have to worry about keeping yourself upright. And part of that is leaning forward, so that the pelvis is tilted, and then leaning back so your spine is kind of in alignment. And that makes it much easier to sit a long time and be relatively comfortable. I say relatively because most of us in the West aren't brought up or trained to sit cross-legged. We sit in chairs. People in Asian countries are used to sitting on the floor. When I was at Metta Forest Monastery down in Southern California, where Tanisra Bhikkhu is the abbot, there was an elderly lady, granny, who helped in the kitchen, and she was in her early 80s, and that girl could sit right on the solid concrete floor with no problems. Us, it would kill probably, you know, but granny did that fine, and she was comfortable. So here in the West, we have to make do. And also, in sitting, I try to find a way to keep my shoulders back. Sometimes I use a pillow under so that my shoulders are pushed back a little bit. And so that brings a more upright kind of posture. And again, that makes it easier to not have the aches and pains that come from sitting for a long time. And it's not infrequent that I would sit in a chair. And when I do so, I find these chairs incredibly hard, so I sit on this waffle cushion and put this little pillow in the small of my back so that it gives good lower back support. So I just mention those things because it's a real challenge for people in meditating, especially if you happen to go on a longer retreat like a day-long, Gil does a half-day retreat on, I think it's every Wednesday, isn't it? Every Wednesday morning. And that's a good way to ease into sitting a little bit longer. And then, as Maureen mentioned, we have a day-long on Saturday, which Gil does once a month. And that's also a good way to really turn up the volume on your practice, to really amplify what you get out of it. And In the years before that I meditated before I started sitting with Gil and training in this tradition, I never sat for very long, but I did so regularly. The teacher that I had taught a technique that utilized concentration for 10 minutes is all, and then about 10 minutes of mindfulness practice. And I did that every day for a long, long time, sometimes twice a day. And it was enough that I got a lot out of it. Probably saved my hide in more ways than I can imagine. And it brought me to this tradition where we sit longer. And the first time I sat for 45 minutes was at a mindfulness-based stress reduction class that was offered here at Kaiser in Redwood City about, what was that, 12 years ago or so. The first time I sat for 45 minutes, I thought I would jump out of my skin. It's like, holy cow, how can, you know, it was like, whew. But having learned some really good techniques from Gil and other teachers on retreats, it's become easier, but it also easier on the body because ligaments and muscles and whatever get stretched out. So you'll notice that before I sit, it's not infrequent, and particularly on a Saturday, I'll do some basic, simple yoga stretches that really help an awful lot in terms of comfort for the day. So as I'm talking, we're looking tonight at mindfulness, and when they asked me a few months ago to do the talk on mindfulness, I thought, oh, that'll be easy. Yeah, no problem. You know, I've heard that a million times. Well, I try to collect my thoughts, and it's like, whoa, where do I start here? And it's not just mindfulness. This is the third of a five-part series on what's called the five faculties. And Chris Clifford did confidence and faith. Last week, Cheryl did effort. Tonight, we're doing mindfulness. And next week, Mick will do concentration. And the week after that, Jen Lemus will do wisdom. And so when I first was asked to do that, I thought, well, why? What's this five faculties thing? And so as I began looking at it in greater depth, it was the qualities here that I just mentioned are five things that stand out in many, many, many of the Buddha's list. You may have, hear the four this, the five that, the three whatevers, and the eight, those things, you know. And I don't know about you, but my mind doesn't hold that kind of stuff. I know some people do very well. I was on a concentration retreat with a guy. And that was his mantra. He would go through all of these lists, and that was very helpful for him because it helped him become grounded and settled. My mind just doesn't retain that kind of stuff. But I can reference each one of them individually as they come up, and I've been hearing these talks for so long that probably they pop up in the back of my mind when I'm not really wanting to find some of these ideas, but they're there nonetheless. So how many of you have heard the first two talks? Has anybody been here? Some, three, four? Yeah, okay, good. So you're familiar with some of those qualities. I'll just review that real briefly. Chris, on confidence and faith. By having faith, it means some notion that there's a benefit to this, and the confidence that goes to balance that faith. Last week, Cheryl was talking on effort, and right effort is putting in enough, but not too much, because then that falls into grasping or clinging or striving, and not too little, because then that falls into sloth and torpor. So that's an important balance. They put the mindfulness thing right in the middle, because it helps to draw together these other four qualities. And as I said, Mick will be talking about concentration next week. And then Jen on wisdom. And wisdom is an important thing, because it's quite helpful to know, well, does this really make sense? Otherwise, why do it? And it's important not to have too much focus on the wisdom, because it can be all a head trip. You know, you probably heard Gil use the term nightstand Buddhist or something like that, where people, they just read and they don't really practice. And certainly they learn and benefit something. And if someone doesn't have that knowledge, they aren't able to draw from all the hard work that these many thousands, tens of hundreds of thousands of people over the years have learned and benefited from, and we're honored to have passed down to us. And I feel very fortunate to be part of this community. Concentration that Mick will talk about next week is a really important and rather elusive topic sometimes, because, you know, we all come, most of us anyway, to meditation to think, okay, well, I'm going to really quiet my mind and I'll just really be blissed out and this will be just great and I'll be enlightened in, you know, a year or so. And I don't know about you, but I sit down after many years and my mind is here, there, and everywhere. And I'd strongly encourage, as I was saying earlier, the longer retreats, because it was on a longer meditation retreat, actually when I first started this practice, that I happened to fall into, it was slowly going in that direction, a deeper state of concentration than I could have attained just in my normal day-to-day sitting, because to have the concentration, it's crucial to be free of all of the distractions and the busyness that our minds get into in the Western culture, our televisions, our cell phones, the answering machine, the family, the work, the traffic, the yada, yada, yada. And so it's to quiet the mind down in concentration. To me, it felt like I was trying to slow down a big truck without any brakes, because my mind had so much inertia that it really took a while. It took 3 days or four before my mind begins to quiet down. And in that time, the mindfulness is quite helpful. So what do we mean by mindfulness? Commonly used term. And probably like me, get flyers in the mail or see advertisements all the time about this mindfulness workshop or that one. And sometimes I wonder how many of these people teaching these workshops really have even practiced this. But nonetheless, it's a helpful approach. And what we mean by that is just bare noting, paying attention to what's happening right here and right now. So mindfulness is being aware that readily our minds, 99.9%, are pasting or futuring. And rarely are we present here and now. And being present here and now is very grounding. And meditation itself helps to turn up the volume on the intuition. And when we're present here and now, there's a very deep peace that comes from that. If you were here on Sunday, you heard Gil's talk. He was mentioning a therapist who had a client that was very, very, very troubled. And the client had to go on a trip somewhere on a bus. And the therapist was quite concerned that whether this guy could really do it, because he was really, really a very paranoid and anxious and worried and disturbed kind of guy. But he gave him the practice of mindfulness. He said, as you're on the bus, look out the window and just notice what you see. You'll see a tree. You'll see a lady. You'll see a post. You'll see a car. Just notice those things. Just be aware of them. Don't get into a story about it. Just bare noting is what he was describing. And it happened to be very helpful for the guy, because otherwise his mind would have gone into all these worried, paranoid, troubled thoughts about things that may or may not really even exist. And so it can help somebody with a profound disturbance like that, and it can help the rest of us that are on a maybe healthier end of the continuum, but still, who doesn't get stressed and tense? And I found lately, when I am finding myself agitated or irritated or impatient is probably a common one for me, I've been allowing myself or reminding myself to focus more and more on just right now. So I'm not in a hurry to get finished with whatever it is, and I'm not worrying about the past. I just focus on the tips of my nostrils or whatever's going on in the room. Maybe there's talking going on or sounds or light or whatever. And so that's what mindfulness is just paying attention to the five senses. And there are these long lists of what is the factors of mindfulness. And I won't go into all that, because I frankly find it a little bit confusing, you know, because they talk about feelings, but they don't really mean emotions, you know. So it's like, what it boils down to for me is, on meditation retreats, they always start with mindfulness of the breath and focusing on the tip of the nose and where the air comes in. So it's not following the oxygen down into your lungs and back up out the throat, because that's a movement and it begins to stir the mind up. It's just focusing on the tip of the nose. And Gil sometimes talks about allowing yourself to notice your stomach rising and falling, your chest rising and falling. And if that's useful, that's a fine thing for myself. It seems to start getting my mind a little bit more spun up. Or if I jump into the bare noting aspect of mindfulness, just noting everything I see, the lights out there, the clock, the carpet, the people in the room. If I start that too soon, my mind tends to doesn't quiet down like it would if I keep a focus in a more single spot. So, one of the aspects that are covered in these five faculties have to do with confidence and faith and wisdom. So, in order for any of us to be here, there was a reason. So, what brought you here? What made you decide to begin meditating? Not necessarily tonight, unless this is your first time, but if you could just mention, we won't pass the mic around, I'll just repeat, but just kind of a one or two word phrase so that I can, otherwise I might not remember it. But what brought you here? What brought you to meditation, I mean?
Stress.
Anxiety.
Deepen my practice.
To deepen your practice. What brought you to meditation initially to even have a practice?
Find your center.
You had a sense that something was off in terms of being centered or grounded. Mm-hmm. Okay. What else?
Restlessness. To be able to
appreciate.
People who should be appreciated, or mm-hmm. my life.
Mm. Appreciate your life and appreciate people in your life. Okay. Pardon?
Quiet my mind.
To quiet your mind. How's it gone? Is it quiet now?
I want to wouldn't say it's totally quiet, but much more quiet than it used to be, or at least I can notice when I'm thinking a lot instead of just doing it without even being aware of it.
You can notice when you're thinking instead of being so unconscious of it. You're aware when you're thinking too much, and it's helped to quiet. Good. Yeah, those are all very similar things to what brought me to meditation. When I first moved here to go to school, turn on Channel 9 one night. I generally have never passed or now current watch television, but I was visiting and turned on the television, and there was a program called Middle Class Meditation, and a four-part series that PBS did. And the teacher was Betty Bathards from the Inner Light Foundation in Novato. And I think the foundation still exists. It's a long time ago. And she was describing some of the qualities of what comes from meditation. And I thought meditation was something strange people in the Himalayas did. You know, it's like, you know, what is this? But she started talking about it helps to turn up the volume on your intuition. It helps to give a quieter mind. It helps to get lower the sense of anxiety or stress or tension that a couple people mentioned. So those were the things that drew me to it. And it's like, I thought, that's kind of interesting. And she was giving a lecture a few nights later in San Jose. I was in Santa Cruz at that time visiting my aunt. And so I went to the lecture, and I really found it to be quite compelling. And I joined a group and meditated. She was teaching. She had various teachers all over the Bay Area volunteering to teach meditation. And so I went to a group in Santa Rosa where my dad lived for a while before I moved to the Bay Area for school. And when I moved here, there wasn't a group starting. So I called Betty to try to find one. And she says, well, you teach it. I'll come up here and I'll show you how to do it. And it's like, I'm just learning. She says, we use a concentration, your mind on one single thing. It can be a candle flame, having the candle flame represent love or peace. Or it can be a rose. Or you can have your eyes closed and have it be your breath. And then if your eyes are open, after 10 minutes, she had us kind of putting our hands together so as to concentrate energy. Then opening your hands as you close your eyes and begin a mindfulness process. And it was very simple and very doable. And one of the things that I found after doing this, partly because I was leading the group, that people came over to my house, it was about 15, for 8 weeks. And then after the 8 weeks was over, they wanted to continue. And so we moved to another member of the group's home. And that group continued for many, many, many years. And it brought a real coming together, a real synergy of energy. And that goes to what we have studied, and you've heard many times in Buddhist studies, the triple gem, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And so I didn't realize it then, because it wasn't a particularly Buddhist philosophy. We studied all kinds of different stuff, and that was one of the things that was very inspiring about the group, is that some people were studying Hindu practices, some were studying mystical Christianity, and you name it. But we were all excited about it, and every week, every Sunday night, without fail, I'd come back from skiing or I'd come from the beach to be with the group at Mac and Wilma's house. And so we'd share what we had learned, and that's essentially what the Sangha is, and that's what happens here, is a synergy of energy. So your intentionality combines with yours and yours and yours and mine and Aaron's, and it comes together to bring a total that's greater than the sum of the parts. So we've got this synergy, and the Dharma are the wisdom teachings. And I like what the Buddha says, as I mentioned earlier, that try it. Don't believe it on blind faith. If it works for you, fine. But try it of your own experience. And most of us that have stuck with this practice have given it a good try. And it, for me, was very helpful sitting, making the agreement with myself and the group members that we would sit every day for 20 minutes. And it's pretty doable. Unfortunately, I'm not as vigilant in doing that now as would be helpful, actually. Even 20 minutes, when I do sit, it's usually for 30 or 20, 30, 40 minutes, whatever, depending on how much time. And for me, what works, and I would encourage you to look and see at your own schedule when that will really work for you. And just like you have a schedule for taking a shower or brushing your teeth or combing your hair, you do it at a certain time. It's not sort of most of the time willy-nilly throughout the day. You do it at a time and it works for you, and you don't forget your shower because that's when you take a shower. And if meditation is folded into that, then that becomes a regular part of your day. And if it doesn't need to be any long, big, blown out, you know, 45 minutes or something, if that works, wonderful. If it doesn't, 5, 10, or 20 minutes is building a discipline. And one of the things that I saw recently in some research is that when people make a commitment to themselves and also to another person that they'll do something and have a time frame and a way to do it, they have 8 times greater likelihood of actually following through with doing it than somebody that just says, oh, I'd like to meditate. But if I say, I'd like to meditate, I want to meditate, I'm going to meditate, and what will work for me, I think, is first thing in the morning. So I carve that out of my schedule and I make the intent to do it. For me, that doesn't work so well first thing in the morning. It works better at night, because in the morning my mind is kind of busy. So that's changed some over the years. But find a time, what time works for you, and have that be your holy time, your personal time. It doesn't have to obviously be any kind of religious trip, but so we've looked at the triple gem. We've looked at why we meditate. We've looked at finding a condition that's conducive to that. For me, that means making sure that the phone is off, making sure that I'm not going to be disrupted by, or it's the best I can, the computer's off. And it worked for me. I realized when I first started meditating that, as I mentioned, I really haven't ever been much of a television person. It was rather a coincidence that I even had the TV on when I was visiting in Santa Cruz, but things happen when they're supposed to happen, I guess. But I found that I would read before I meditate some kind of inspiring material, and it helped to put my mind in a special state that was much more conducive to meditation than if I try to meditate after checking my email, after checking my voicemail, after surfing the web. It's like, forget it, my mind is all over the place. But if I've been reading something that of the teachings that happen to be inspirational, and particularly doing so with a mindfulness, being present, noticing periodically the chair under me, noticing the impulse to go grab the phone or whatever it might be, and just staying present, then my meditation is deeper, my mind is quieter. So it's looking at some of those qualities that are in all those lists that we talk about, protecting the mind states, avoiding defilements, avoiding situations that will have your mind stirred up. Because obviously if we've been sitting and watching crime shows and violence and murder and nasty behavior, we're not going to be able to meditate so well. So it's finding a condition. So I'm not preaching, but if it works for you to watch all kinds of TV and then meditate, maybe your mind needs the quiet and it's fine. The important thing is what works for you. So what is it that gets in the way for you? I've mentioned some for me. What couple things are the main things that have gotten in the way, and what helps you to be able to practice in a more skillful or in a more useful kind of way? Again, I'll just repeat if you'll mention briefly what helps you and what doesn't help. Noticing positive shifts. You mean like shifts in your broader life? Okay.
Having a space to place in my house.
It's hard to find a place that really consistently works for you. Yeah, that is helpful when you can, yeah. Just like coming here. When we've been here, usually we've been here for meditation, so just by walking into this building, our minds become a little quieter, because that's how we associate this building. If you've had bad experiences on the bus, you probably get a little anxious getting on the bus. But if we have a spot in our room or our lives where it's quieter, it's very helpful. What else? What gets in the way? What helps?
What gets in my way is when I eat before I meditate, and I'm just all over the place. And it's pretty consistent.
Yeah.
I practice that. Yeah, sometimes if I want to meditate, I've eaten. I'd rather meditate and still be all over the place as opposed to not meditating.
Yeah.
But, and I also find the consistency, as you said, about picking a time. And, you know, I'm not always on the time, you know, particular time each day, but at least it's my goal.
Right.
And then if I push it and I have to, that's fine too.
You're being flexible with the time, but having a consistent time works well for you. And also, I mean, that was one of the things that Betty taught us also in the basic instructions, is to, if possible, to try to meditate before you eat. And certainly not meditating after having wine or beer or something like that, because you want your mind to have a little bit more of a control. So I found it, and also something I learned from Betty, is a balance mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. So when I felt out of sorts, I would look and see what's missing. Physically, am I healthy? Am I exercising? Mentally, am I getting stimulation? Am I developing whatever one might call the spiritual practice? And is there a balance there? And in terms of mindfulness, one of the things that many teachers encourage is beginning the practice, certainly focusing on the breath and the nostrils. But to quiet the mind, it's often very helpful to have some more active things, because if you try to slow the mind down really fast, it doesn't do that so much, so easily. And so one of the things that's often recommended is a metta meditation experience. And that's, people have done metta workshops here on our website. There are lectures about that. But basically metta is repeating to yourself four or five phrases. And it's wishing well for yourself, wishing well for other people, wishing well for the broader community, for the country, for the planet, and just kind of moving out from there. And the phrases people adapt to their own preferences. May I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be safe, may I be loving and gentle with myself and others, may I be free and fully liberated, stuff like that. And just saying those, whatever three or four or five work for you, and saying it first for yourself, and then giving it away to a mentor or somebody who's inspired or guided you, a neutral person, and ultimately a difficult person, and then spreading out. And pretty soon it's to the entire universe, and the mind can take on a very expansive, peaceful, and profound quality. And some of the techniques for getting into deeper concentration also, Ayakema's book talks about that, about using a metta practice to go into the deeper states of concentration. So that's one of the things that's quite helpful. Gil taught a class in concentration a few years ago, and he had us memorize the Metta Sutta. And just saying that kind of gives the mind something. It's like a little kid, you know, or a puppy, you know. If you don't give it something to do, it's going to get in trouble. So giving the mind something to do, just repeating an inspirational poem or something you might have memorized over the years is very helpful, and it helps to quiet the mind. And then when that's finished, it's for me much easier to come back to the breath. And the factors in the... It's important to look at what we're talking here is the formal practice, and that's our sitting. And equally, if not more important, is the informal practice. And that is, what do we do throughout the day? How or can we bring our focus into a state of mindfulness as we're going through our daily lives? And one of the things that is helpful is just to kind of look at different things. Like one guy told me once that he was in a stress class and they encouraged him driving to work to get in the slowest lane, whatever the slowest lane, and just chill, just stay there. And he said they had mentioned about some research that showed that people that were weaving in and out, you know, might in 10 miles get somewhere just a minute or two or three faster than somebody, if that, that was just sitting there. And he said, when I did that, it made a huge difference. And when I go to the grocery store or the bank, I get in the longest line. So I'm not in a hurry. So, and what that can be is a wonderful opportunity for mindfulness. Because if I'm in my car and I'm holding the steering wheel, I'm noticing this car. Oh, I like that one. Oh, I don't like that one. Why is this guy driving? It's a wonderful thinking, judging. And Cheryl's mentioned that driving to work, she would see people in a certain brand of car, which shall be unnamed, dodging in and out and driving very fast, or motorcycles. And finding, using a metta as, may that person be safe, please. You know, driving on a motorcycle like that, splitting lanes, it's like, and so it makes it much easier to have compassion. And so the point of a metta practice isn't that you're going to fix somebody else. What it means is putting your own mind, your own consciousness, into a state of peacefulness and a greater sense of well-being. Because if I'm walking around always judging other people, then guess what? I expect that's how the world is. So if that's how the world is, then I'm being judged constantly by everybody else. And so that it's not very conducive to my own peacefulness. So metta and mindfulness can be practiced in many different circumstances. Also on meditation retreats, I'm jumping from the informal practice and now back to the formal practice. Often what's helpful is to do a body sweep, starting with the top of the head, just noting the sensations, the eyes, the face, the neck, the shoulders, the arms, not getting into a dialogue about it, just noticing, oh, there's tightness here. Boy, my leg is really aching. Well, now is this a stabbing, burning, what, aching, okay. And just being aware of what that is. And one of the things that I didn't mention, which I found to be really helpful, is in Vipassana, it's less formal than like Zen. In Zen, you need to sit straight upright, you don't move, and it's a very disciplined kind of practice. In Vipassana, we're a little more loosey-goosey about that, and that's good news and it's bad news. So if you need to move, you need to move, and just go ahead and move. And so if you want to come in late, you come in late. In Zen, boy, you don't do that. And if you're moving around, you know, in a long Zen retreat, the master comes along and gives, you know, if you ask for it, they don't beat you up. But if you want a crack on the shoulders with some, you know, bamboo things, you know, it kind of loosens the tension. I've wished for that kind of thing. I've never done a Zen retreat, but I understand that's what happens. And it's not painful. It's more releasing the tension. Be also nice to have masseurs and a hot tub, but I guess they don't do that. Well, actually, they do at Tassar. I guess they have hot tubs down there. But what I wanted to say is that I found it to be very helpful in quieting my mind in a shorter sitting or longer to find a posture, as I was describing early, where I could sit comfortably and then not move a muscle. I mean, still, solid. And I mean, if I needed to move, I would. But I find a lot of times I think I need to move or scratch, you know, and pretty soon I'm moving all over the place and doing the heebie-jeebies on the cushion, and my mind is doing likewise. So I find that it's quite grounding to notice, okay, I'm wanting to move, and just breathing through it, noticing the impulse. And when we notice the multitude of impulses we have throughout our days that we don't need to act on. That's extremely liberating, and that's what Vipassana means. Vipassana means insight. So if we have insight that, oh, cause and effect, and we're talking about just sitting and how that's useful. And you don't have to sit that way. They don't tell us we need to. They encourage that we do that. But also if we look at what circumstances in our lives help us to be spun up and what helps us to be more centered, more compassionate with ourselves and others, that makes a huge difference. So with mindfulness, you start out with the body, the five senses, the mental states. And by that they mean, is it positive, negative, or neutral? So they don't necessarily at some earlier stage encourage you to look at all the emotions, because if you're looking at anger and sadness and fear, it's pretty easy to get all spun up in a story about it. At a later stage, or you may choose to do that. If it works for you, that's great. But if you can just notice, okay, I'm agitated today. I may or may not know why. If I go into a drama of the story, then I'm lost. If I just notice what? Oh, agitation, breathing, sitting, hearing, seeing. I find it to be very a lot more quieting to the mind. I'll talk a little bit about what happens. Mindfulness can be used in the informal practice. When it's used in the formal practice and really stuck to, particularly if you allow a one-pointed focus on the breath, and this is what Mick will talk about more next week, the mind can become more and more and more concentrated, more and more quiet. So it's purposely not allowing the mind to go to sounds in the room, the cars outside, other things that are occurring in the body so much as just to kind of keep coming back to the breath. And it probably takes a longer retreat for this to occur, unless you have a really good sense of concentration. Some people's concentration is like a laser. They can just lock it on. Mine isn't. Mine is like a hummingbird. It's all over the place. So I have to use my breath. I even sometimes close my throat a little bit so that there's a slight sound. Nobody else can hear it, but I can hear it, and it gives my mind something else to do. It's a foundation. It's something a rock to hold on to. And what happens is in this state is, particularly sitting very still, the mind becomes quieter and quieter and quieter. And there's a very profound sense of peacefulness that occurs. And what's happening then, what can happen if you choose to do that, is that there's a mindfulness process occurring inside. And this peacefulness, hindrances have begun to float away. Pain of the body. If there's been any discomfort in the body, the first time it was on a meditation retreat, I realized I've been sitting a long time and I no longer feel any discomfort. Isn't that weird? And the concentration was strong enough that there was an ease with the body. And the thoughts would come up, but they would be like birds in the sky, far, far away. Thoughts that would pop up would be as irrelevant as those birds. I mean, you'd notice them, but they'd go. And my focus was on the breathing, on the breath. And at those times, the breath becomes slower and slower. And sometimes it's been helpful for me to use a mantra. As I breathe in, I am, exhale, at peace. And this again gives my mind something to help become focused and settled on. Um, at some points the breath, it seems as the breath has, since there's such a profound sense of peacefulness in the body, it's as though the breath has even stopped. And that can be a thought. It's like, oh my God, I'm not breathing. What is this? Oh. And of course, we don't need to go there. If I go there, then I'm all spun up. But if I just notice peace, peacefulness, the breath is staying with the breath, mindfully being with what's happening, and it's a natural process that unfolds. And afterwards, I came to a sense of, it was as though the body was well attended somehow. I wasn't doing anything to it, but it was like it was being taken care of. And for a lot of people, there's sensations that begin to appear in the face at this point. It could be a numbness or a tingling. And mindfully, we would stay with those. We wouldn't get into analyzing, oh, what is this? You know, do I have a... Sometimes it might feel like a bug crawling on you. It might hear a sound like a buzzing, a mosquito, or even a bell, just a slight bell ringing way in the distance. It's so quiet you can just barely hear it. And it's clear that's not there other than from some part of your consciousness. And there's a natural unfolding of this that the only way... It's often described as facilitated by a presence, because it rarely happens because my mind isn't usually quiet enough. But when it first happened, there wasn't anybody who explained it. You know, people kind of wouldn't. And so I'm not supposed to be telling you about this, I suppose. Don't tell anybody I told you. Because teachers generally steer people away from it, and for a reason, because one can become very attached to it. And I think I probably did. It was like such a pleasant, profound experience. It's like, what was that? I wasn't on drugs, but something was very different in my consciousness. And there are teachers, Gil guides people who come to that experience. He doesn't per se teach concentration very much. Shyla Catherine is one of the people in the area who has done very, very deep concentration practice, as well as Lee Brazington, who's a teacher at IMC, at Spirit Rock. And as I said, for some reason, some of the teachers directly steer people away from that. And for whatever reason. So let me pause at this point. We've got about 5 or 10 minutes. So are there any questions that any of you have? I've covered a lot of different stuff tonight, and maybe I haven't covered some things that you're interested in or not so clear. So what comes up for you?
When you have trouble staying with the breath, do you ever resort to counting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I do whatever it takes. And Tan Jeff talks about that. Tanisiro Bhikkhu, who has written many of the free books that we have out there, he talks about letting the breath become long, letting it be short, noticing is it long or short. But also counting can be one of the things. Gil encourages that sometimes for walking meditation, in counting each step up to 5, and then going back to 1, up to 6, back to 1, up to 7, and then sequentially up to 10, and then back from 10, up to 9, up to 8, up to 7. And that for me, when I do that for a while, can be very, very settling or very grounding. Important thing is to see, does that work? Maybe you wouldn't need it, or maybe you would, or maybe initially, sometimes if my mind is just all over the place and I try different things, and ultimately, if that works, you know, that's certainly one that I would go to, yeah.
So,
he'll give you the mic there.
I'm wondering if visualizations are considered a form of thought.
So I find sometimes when I start to have thoughts, if I turn it into a visualization, like a cloud or something, it's my way of disassociating from it, so I stop thinking when I don't want to. But then I started thinking, well, maybe having visualizations is just another form of thoughts, and it's not something I would want to entertain.
No, it's completely fine, and that's one of the things that some teachers that teach concentration utilize. I forget what they call it, but kind of a disc. I think sometimes they even have, don't they have people's eyes open, Maureen? You might know about this, and kind of watching.
Casino.
Casino? Okay. So that's an eyes open thing. But for a lot of people, when they, I don't know about a lot, but for some people, when they become more concentrated, their visual imagery that comes up. The teachers that teach concentration talk about vigilantly focusing on nothing but the nose and some crystal kind of thing appearing at a certain point. Nimitta, yeah. Cheryl and I did a retreat with Sister DePunkra a few years ago, and she's a really cool teacher. And she, her teacher from Burma, I guess, what is it, Pa'ok Sayadaw? Teaches that, and but there's what I've been describing. The concentration is called the jhanas, J-H-A-N-A, is that right? And so there's jhana light, and then there's Pa'ok Sayadaw, which is jhana, and his is really deep. I mean, you don't move from the crystal until it's takes you over or something. But for other people, like an image might appear like if you just stare at the moon at night, you know, there's a brightness like a full moon, and then there's kind of a halo around that. That kind of thing appears for some people. And that those are all things that one wouldn't try to create, but be aware that it may appear as part of your consciousness. And so mindfully, unless you didn't want to get into a concentrated state, and you may not want to if there isn't a lot of time, because if you don't have time, or it's important to have a very safe space to do that, because you may end up sitting an hour or two or three. And so it would be important to be in a place where you could just continue sitting. I mean, if that occurred, if they were experienced with it, they would be able to easily exit it. But if somebody is just going there for the first time, it may take a longer time for them to progress through the whatever stages of that. And so, yeah. Visualizing is fine if that's what comes up. And sometimes, as I said, people purposely look at like a disc or something. The only drawback is concentration brings like a heightened sense of awareness. But if we don't do anything like that with it, then it's just like getting high, and that's a nice experience, maybe. But the idea is to quiet the mind and then utilize vipassana or insight. So it's like, what are the higher questions I would ask? And those, the nature of reality. Why am I here? What's the planet? Am I here? Who's here? But the questions are more looking at impermanence, unsatisfactoriness of life, and what's the other one? Impermanence, unsatisfactory.
Not self.
Yeah, that's right. Not self. And so by having a heightened sense of awareness, you can kind of begin to ponder those unanswerable questions. And that's the thing that the teachers that teach that practice. And Mick will go into this more next week, I'm sure. And it's an interesting process. Okay, let's sit for just a minute before we finish. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as me or mine. Whoever has heard this has heard all of the teachings, the Buddha indicated. May all beings be free and fully liberated. Thank you. Oh, one thing I didn't mention is there's a householder retreat that happens that Andrea Feller does early in March, and that is really, really a good way, without knocking yourself out with a long retreat, to deepen your practice. It starts on Sunday, March the 8th, and goes that Sunday afternoon after the sitting, and then it's every morning and every evening, Monday through Friday, and then it ends, and then there's a retreat all day, is it, on Saturday that she does. And she gives very, very practical pointers about mindfulness and particularly how to integrate mindfulness into your day-to-day life. And I'd highly recommend it. You don't have to go to all the things. Sometimes you can go in the morning and sometimes you can't, whatever, but, you know, try to come as many as you can. But she's a really good teacher, very good, and I'd highly recommend that. And Maureen, Cheryl and I have gone, and whether Aaron, other people have, well, everybody really seems to appreciate that. So thanks very much. And I'll be around for a little while if anybody wants to.